Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on crime is a growth industry right after this. You know, Americans today are interrogated, watched, measured, and counted more than at any time in our history. And surveillance and electronic record keeping of nearly every routine activity, from bank deposits to medical visits, has produced greater efficiency and security, all right. But it's also responsible for a very discernible erosion of our ability to live our lives free from outside scrutiny. Now, our federal government currently maintains an average of 15 files on every American. Now, that's according to estimates by the Office of Management and Budget. And closer to home, our state and local governments also use computers to keep their own files on us. And a study conducted by the New York Committee on Open Government found that that state and its agencies operated 1,776 separate data systems containing 10,799 categories of information about New York residents. And each one of those systems contained between 2 and 10 million records. Now, this information about you is gained from 63 sources. And this information is gathered and stored in a very reasoned and logical manner for later retrieval and use. Now, would you like to know how your government, your bank, your insurance company, and how industry obtains all of this information about you? What are their sources? How is it stored? How is it retrieved? What do they want it for? Knowing how this information is gathered and what information is being stored and what information you want to keep personal and private actually puts you in the driver's seat in your quest for privacy. Now, if you'd like more information about privacy and privacy issues, just call us at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package, and let me tell you how to train yourself to be just as personal and just as private as you want to be. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website at georgegordon.org, just georgegordon.org. Click on to the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about crime. Crime is a growth industry. Crime is a business. Crime is big business. And just like the auto industry, or telecommunications industry, the pharmaceutical industry, the construction industry, there's a crime industry. And there's a lot of people who are being employed in the criminal justice system. These people employed in the criminal justice system make their livings off of crime. If there wasn't any crime, there wouldn't be any criminals. And if there weren't any criminals, there wouldn't be any bail bondsmen. So look in your telephone directory, and you'll see bail bondsmen. There'll be 20 or 30 of them located in the yellow pages, you know, if you're living in any kind of major city. All of those people would be unemployed without the crime growth industry. Take a look at all the policemen that you see running around on the streets. If there weren't any criminals, if all of us obeyed all the laws all the time, what would we need policemen for? And so millions of people who are involved in the policing business, there's about a million policemen in the United States, And then there's all of the people that work in all these police departments, you know, like the dispatchers and all of the secretaries and the file cabinet girls, you know, that are filing all these papers away, and computer programmers and so on. Now, of course, somebody's going to say, well, yeah, but, you know, that's wishful thinking. We have all of these criminals out here. Well, wait a minute. Let's stop and think now. What is a criminal? What is a criminal? Who is it that we want to target in our big net that we're catching all these criminals in? You know, every time you pass a law, you restrict somebody's liberty to some degree. So there are some laws that have been determined to be in the public interest, or maybe I should word a little differently, that violate the public trust and aren't in the public interest and we need to abolish. Murder's one of those crimes. And the guy that came up with the idea that killing people was a bad program was the Creator himself, God. He said, that's a bad program. We don't want murderers out here. So he created his own law. He came up and he says, you shall do no murder. We pretty much follow that here in the United States. If somebody goes out and murders somebody, we get pretty hot and heavy on that. And we run out and catch him and we lock him up. Now, God comes along with another step and he says, murderers need to be killed. That's where capital punishment comes from. It wasn't something that was thought up by your state legislature. Long before the state of Mississippi came up with the death penalty, there was a death penalty. Hell, it goes clear back to the Garden of Eden. God himself came up with the death penalty for murder. Now, he came up with 24 crimes, 24 categories of crime for which we need the death penalty. And then, fortunately for God, we came along on the scene. That's you and me and our legislators and Dianne Feinstein and Ted Kennedy and all those guys. And we came to the conclusion that God had made a terrible, awful mistake and that we ought not to have, that we shouldn't have death penalties for everything. We needed to correct. We needed to fix. We needed to repair this whole process of crime and punishment. And so we did. We did. And in the United States, at our federal level, we call this Title 18 of the U.S. Code. And Title 18 is our criminal justice system. And we spell out crimes and punishments. Crimes and punishments. Now, to give you an illustration, here's from the Bible the 24 crimes that require the death penalty. Murder, right at the top of the list. Smiting of parents. That is, you slap your mother across the face, we take you out, and we stone you to death. See, we came to the conclusion that slapping your mother across the face is not worthy of death, and so we changed that. Kidnapping is punishable by death. Well, in some cases it is, we've decided, but not in every case, and so therefore we'll just lock kidnappers up in prison for a while. Cursing of parents, that is, just cussing them out or being disrespectful, is worthy of death. We came to the conclusion that that was far, far too severe. So we changed that law. We don't punish people for cursing their parents. Abortion. We look at abortion today, and abortion is a crime punishable by death in the Bible, but we came along and said, no, we think that we'll change that and use that as a modality of birth control. So, abortion, which is a capital felony in the scripture, we've turned that into a system whereby we can have birth control. Then we have negligent property liability resulting in death, daylight shooting of a thief resulting in death, witchcraft. Hell, we don't think that witchcraft should be punishable by death. We even set aside a particular day to honor witches and witchcraft. We call it Halloween here in this country. Bestiality, that sexual relations with animals, God thought was worthy of death. We said, no, that's recreation. Idolatry, God thought that that was worthy of death. And we said, no, that's protected by freedom of religion, First Amendment. profaning the Sabbath. And we said, no, 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 everybody needs to work on Sunday. Adultery, we thought that should be repealed. So the death penalty for adultery, incest, sodomy, and the marriage of a man to both a mother and her daughter, or sexual relations between a mother and her daughter, commonly known as pedophiles or pedophilia, I guess it is. We said, no, 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 we need to change those laws. And the false prophets? No, we honor our false prophets by making them pastors in our churches. Then reviling priests and judges. Now, we call that, in court today, we call that contempt of court. But we don't put people to death for getting uppity with the judge. Perjury, and that's false witness, which in a capital crime would result in somebody's death. That's fine. You can go into court and lie about people. In fact, we just got a famous case the other day. The governor of Mississippi, I believe it was, or the governor of Alabama, that's what it was, had been targeted by the Bush administration, and so he was prosecuted and put in prison. Well, they found out it was a political prosecution, so he was just released the other day. I just thought I'd point that out. Perjury. He was lied about and perjured, and they put him in prison. Incorrigible delinquency. You know, that's where you've got street gangs of juvenile delinquents running around shooting people off of street corners. Well, God thought that they ought to be put to death, but we came to a better conclusion than God. That's because we're all smarter than God. And then rape. We don't put people to death for rape anymore. Usury. Everybody's got a credit card and paying usury. Well, we wouldn't want to apply the death penalty for usury, would we? And then oppressing widows and orphans. Hell, that's sport in this country. Now, that's 24 crimes that are punishable by death in the scripture. And except for murder, and if you kill somebody in a kidnapping or a treason, I don't think there are any other crimes worthy of death, are there? Now, we have a big crime problem here in the United States, and we have a big crime problem because we have a different way of dealing with crime than God does in the Bible. This God of the Bible, I'm not talking about Jesus the way in the manger or Buddha or Allah or somebody else. I'm talking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the guy that Moses was dealing with up on Mount Sinai. Hey, that guy ain't too kind, he ain't too gentle. And I thought I'd share with you a couple of three of his policies, you know, crime and punishment type policies, so that we can see that there is a clear-cut distinction. Now, the reason that crime is a growth industry is because we are buying crime. So in the last program, I showed you how the public officials go before the legislatures, and they say, well, crime grew by 5%, so here's what we need to do to curb crime. Hey, we've been fighting the drug war for years and years, haven't we? Yeah, sure. President Nixon is the one that started this war on drugs, wasn't it? I think it was Nixon. War on drugs. And every president, we have a drug czar here in the United States. Took it right from you Russians up there. Czar, drug czar. You know, that's the indisputable dictator over drug enforcement policy. We call him our drug czar. And yet, drugs and drug dealers and the drug trade grows every year. In fact, the biggest single agricultural crop in America is marijuana. Marijuana growing in the United States is bigger than wheat, bigger than soybeans, bigger than cotton, bigger than corn, boys and girls. And there's no price supports and there's no government, protection, you know, for marijuana growers. It's the free marketplace. I mean, if you want to see how powerful the free market is, take a look at marijuana growing in the United States. You have to hide it, secret it away. It's $37 billion a year industry. Yeah. Now, the law enforcement growth industry in this country is a $41 billion a year industry, and marijuana growing all by itself is just a little bit behind it, $37 billion. $4 billion left. Add to that cocaine and heroin and the other drugs, ecstasy and so on. Hell, the drug business is bigger than law enforcement. I'm going to say two times over at least, maybe three or four. And that's all free enterprise. All right, so I thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. Now, in a little town named Nampa, Idaho, let me show you how this works. Nampa, Idaho. Back in the 1970s, somebody woke up one day and said, we need a shopping mall. And so they built Karcher Mall. Karcher Mall is west of Nampa, Idaho, there in the Treasure Valley. And as a result of that, they built the big mall out there. The little businesses that were in downtown Nampa went out to the mall and opened their store out there. They closed their store in downtown Nampa and went out to the mall. Or, if they didn't go out to the mall, then the people all went out to the mall to do their shopping, and the store owners in downtown Nampa went bankrupt, went out of business, and closed their doors because there wasn't any business. So when I moved up to Idaho in the early 1970s, and I happened to go out there to the Karcher Mall a couple of times, and then I happened to go to downtown Nampa, I was absolutely amazed. Here was this town of Nampa, probably population 10,000 or something like that, pretty good sized town. And the stores, about half the stores in town were boarded up and closed. It was like a ghost town. And I was just absolutely amazed. I'd never seen anything like it before. I said, wow, that's what the mall does. Well, that's what Walmart does when they move into town. Closes up half the stores in town. So some time went on, and there was a lot of talk. The Idaho Statesman had articles, and there was opinions and one thing and another about how do we revitalize downtown Nampa. And everybody knew that it was the mall that did it. And so, you know, they would have campaigns on, and they wanted to beautify downtown Nampa, and they wanted to revitalize it, and they're talking about getting government tax money in there to rehabilitate downtown. And so some time went on, 2 or 3 years went on, nothing that they could think of was going to do anything. And then someday, sometime, somehow, somebody said, let's take out all the parking meters in downtown Nampa. Oh my God, they just run it. It was like hitting a brick wall at 99 miles an hour. I mean, there was controversy. There was ranting and raving and jumping up and down and pawing the ground and biting the bushes. And the guys that said, take out the parking meters, said, first of all, you don't need them because there isn't anybody in downtown Nampa that you have to ration the parking to start with because they're all shopping at Karcher Mall where they get free parking. Yeah, that's right, free parking. So let's think about this for a minute. Now, if you're living in San Francisco, California, say, where they've got parking meters and they've got a real problem with parking and too many cars, you'll know what the problem is and where we're going with this. You go into San Francisco and there's parking meters every place. And if you're fortunate enough to find a place to park your car, it costs you an arm and a leg while you're putting money into the meter, you know, you're feeding this meter, and you get an hour. Now you're going to go shopping for an hour. Now you come back in 61 minutes and you got a ticket on your windshield, and that ticket's going to cost you $15-$20. So people don't like having to shop in the city because of the parking hassle. There's no place to park, number one, and number two, we've got to pay money to park. That's a no-no. Number three, we're going to get a ticket, and maybe our car get towed off, and it's just... So, we jump in our car, we drive 25 miles, and we go to the shopping mall. So, shopping malls have just proliferated all over America. I mean, everybody shops at the shopping mall. Nobody goes into downtown Springfield. I haven't been to downtown Springfield for so long, I don't even know what the hell it looks like. Why? And parking meters all over the place. Why, they got parking meter maids. And besides that, all the businesses have moved out of downtown are all out the shopping mall. And when I pull into the shopping mall, I've got, oh my God, there must be 100 stores in the Battlefield Mall. Maybe 200, I don't know. Hell, it takes me 10 minutes just to read the index when you walk in the door, you know, as to where all these stores are. I mean, it's just everything that you want is there at the mall, and the parking's free, and there's no hassles. And it doesn't make any difference. I could go into the mall, and I could meet you there, and you could say, hey, George, let's go over and have an Orange Julius. And we can just walk over and sit down and have an Orange Julius. I don't have to watch my watch and say, oh my God, I got to run out and feed the parking meter. And then I run out to feed the parking meter and I'm too late. I already got a ticket on the windshield. And so the shopping mall takes all that hassle off, and that's why people shop there. So anyway, they argued and fought over this Karcher Mall downtown Napa thing for a while, and one day they came to the conclusion, let's take out all the parking meters, and they did. They took out all the parking meters, and in less than a year, every store in downtown Napa had a new tenant and a new business. And downtown Napa was thriving. Thriving. And then somebody woke up one day and said, you know what we need in downtown Napa? We need parking meters. And who do you think were the primary purveyors of parking meters in downtown Napa? You guessed it. All the merchants in Karcher Mall. See, they discovered the secret. The secret is people don't like hassles. We just don't like it. And a parking ticket is a hassle. Feeding the meter is a hassle. And then when I feed the meter in downtown San Francisco, I'm in a hurry. It's not leisurely at all, because I've got to hurry. And when I'm in this store, I got to get checked out, because I got to get back out to my car and get moving, because if I'm in a hurry, it's push, push, push. It's hurry, hurry, hurry. When I go to the shopping mall, hell, I can have lunch. I can be shopping away, and I can take my time, and I find that I'm hungry, and it's noon. Hey, let's stop and have a pizza. And there's about 10 or 15 restaurants in the Battlefield Mall. I mean, you don't have to eat McDonald's. I mean, hell, you can go over here and sit down. You can have, you know, you can probably eat Indian cuisine in there. All right, now here's the moral to the story. Regulation is a detriment to business. I told you that in the last program. And parking meters are a part of regulation. And it kills business. That's what the bottom line is. It just kills business. Now, of course, there's more congestion in downtown Napa than there is out in the Walmart parking lot. But you know, Walmart's smart enough not to put parking meters into their parking lot. Let me ask you this. Let's suppose Walmart puts parking meters in their parking lot. How many people do you think are going to shop at Walmart? Now, you see, government over the parking in downtown, they have a monopoly. And the government bureaucrat, he's not dependent upon the customers going in and out of those stores. He doesn't care. He just cares about generating revenue for the city government. And thousands of people, in their everyday pursuit of life, putting quarters in parking meters generates millions of dollars of revenue. And that's what their business is. Their business is generating revenue. And the same thing is true with Springfield and their cameras at the busy intersections. Now, let me tell you what a detriment that is for you people in Springfield. I'm a farmer, and I live out here in the countryside. And I want to go to town. And I have to choose between going to West Plains or Springfield. Now, in Springfield, when I go to Springfield and I'm driving around, it's a bigger city and it's more congested. And now they've installed spy devices at the major intersections to catch me running the red light. Do I want to go to Springfield and run the risk of being hassled by getting a ticket at the red light? Or do I want to go to West Plains where they don't have any of those tickets? Those ticket-giving devices. Now, you merchants, now, listen up. Because I'm the guy, I'm the customer, see? And I got to choose between Springfield and West Plains. Let me tell you what my choice is. It's West Plains. It's not because West Plains offers better stores, better shopping, or better prices. Because they don't. But they've got less hassle in West Plains than they do in Springfield. Now, the public officials that came up with the idea of putting a camera at the corner of Glenstone and Sunshine. They're not selling anything out of the stores. They're not concerned with whether or not I'm going to come to Springfield to go shopping or not. Their concern is, how can we generate more revenue for the city government? So they say, well, if we go out and we raise taxes, then the voters are going to be upset and they're going to vote us out of office. So we want more money to spend. We want more money for whatever it is that government bureaucrats are spending money on. So how do we raise that money? Well, we could raise that money by giving more tickets for running the red light. But we've got to have a reason or an excuse. So remember, the reason or excuse is it's for the health, safety, and welfare of the public. That's preposterous poppycock. And everybody knows that. Well, anybody that's got an IQ above 80 can figure that out. Now remember, you think about this. You're at the red light and you're stopped. You're stopped. You look up, it's a red light, and that's why you're stopped. You look to your right, you look to your left, and there are cars going through the intersection. Choop, 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 choop. Cars, swish, swish, are going through the intersection. You're not going forward because the light's red, and if you go forward, one of those cars going through the intersection is going to hit you. You're not dumb. You can see that. All right. Now, the light turns yellow, and a guy over there steps on the gas and races through the intersection, but the light turns red when he's halfway through. Can you tell me how that's a threat to you? For you to hit that guy halfway through the intersection, your light would have to turn green, you'd have to floorboard it, you'd have to have a monster dragger that could go from zero to 60 in 300ths of a second to get out there and hit that car going through the intersection. It's impossible. Can't never happened in the past, ain't happening today, and ain't never going to happen in the future. And you know it, and so do I, and so does the jerk that put the camera up there. His motivation is to generate revenue for the city. And the best way to generate revenue for the city is in fines. You know, while we're out here protecting the health, safety, and welfare of the public. Now, none of us complain about that because, after all, we don't run red lights, do we? But all of us have to make that decision every time you're coming up to the red light. You got green, it turns yellow. Do I step on the gas or slam on the brakes? You got to make that decision every time. Well, I don't need to worry about it in West Plains. I got to be real concerned about it in Springfield. And so I'm sitting here in Isabella, Missouri, and I'm saying, should I go to Springfield or should I go to West Plains? So for all you Springfield merchants, let me tell you where my vote is. It's West Plains. And anything that I can buy in West Plains, Mountain Home, Ava, that's where I go. Because they haven't got that trap there to hassle me. Okay, now there's another thought here. You don't have any parking meters over in West Plains either. I can go into downtown West Plains and park anywhere. Well, any place I can find a parking place. And I don't have to be concerned about the parking meter lady. So anytime that I'm concerned about a hassle, I try to avoid it. And I just presume that there's a lot of other people out there just like me avoiding hassles. So, when we're talking about Nampa, Idaho, and the parking meters in Karcher Mall, I told you the story. And when they took the parking meters out, Nampa was just revitalized. Now, there's a little thought for you people in San Francisco. If you want to know why I would avoid San Francisco, it's because of the hassle that's there. Now, you know, there are people that can stand the hassle, but for all of us non-hassles, we don't go there. So there's the story on regulation. The more you regulate business, the more regulation you put on, the less business you're going to have. And you can regulate to the point that you can just drive business right out of business. And that's what you're doing in America. You have driven your industries and your businesses to China. And the industries and the businesses aren't moving to China because they want to. They're moving there because there's less hassle and there's more profit. So we just don't want to argue with OSHA and the EPA. We just don't want the hassle. So we move out where the hassle is less and the profits are greater. And that's not a benefit to Americans. It's a benefit to the Chinese. And before we had regulation in America, it was a benefit to America. And we became the wealthiest, most powerful, prosperous nation in the world without regulation. Now, if you're all for regulation, don't let me get in the way of your happiness and success. But if you're an unemployed supporter of regulation, I just thought I'd tell you why you're unemployed. All right, let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. That's 8 schools in all. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information about our homeschooling program, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. And the Law Hour, an editorial review, gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend will reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, our sponsors, management, or staff of this network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about crime as a growth industry. Now, the difference between the biblical approach to crime and the governmental approach to crime is that God is not trying to make a profit off of crime. God's intention is to eradicate crime, and it has a very logical and systematic end result. Let's try it. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion here, that we've got a criminal activity going on, such as, something that's really obnoxious, say, adultery. That's a good one, adultery. God would like to eliminate adultery. It's bad for families. It's bad for wives. It promotes venereal disease. It promotes divorce, broken homes, juvenile delinquency, alimony, child support, and probably five other things that I haven't thought of yet. Adultery is not really good for us. It's really bad for us. And so God looked at it and he said, you know, I think adultery is so bad that it warrants capital punishment. So he said, thou shalt not commit adultery. And if you catch somebody committing adultery, then take them out and stone them to death. So the state comes along and says, well, now wait a minute. Adultery is a lot of fun. And I got to tell you it is. And I got to concede that adultery is a lot of fun. There's a lot of excitement that goes on with adultery because you don't know if a real man's going to catch you or not. And that adds a lot of spirit to the chase. Now, the state comes along and says, now, if we find people committing adultery, it could be some pretty prominent people. It could be the President of the United States, like Bill Clinton. Now, if we were carrying out the death penalty, he and Monica Lewinsky would be dead today. And we don't want to really kill our president, now, do we? In addition to that, you might get caught, Tom, and gosh, that would end up getting you killed. Mary, yeah, you might get caught too, you know. And so we take a look at our own behavior, our own actions, you know, and so, you know, we like to commit adultery and we really don't want to get killed. And so when the state proposes that we temper our punishments, we're all for it, aren't we? Well, I know that we're all in favor of locking them up and throwing the key away when it comes to a thief, but, you know, you cheat on your income tax, don't you, Bob? Hey, you exaggerate a little bit on your insurance claim, don't you, Tom? So, when we steal, we don't like guys going into the supermarket and holding them up, or into the, you know, the 7-Eleven or the Circle K and holding them up. Now, we don't like that. That's messy. But, you know, stealing from the insurance company or on the income tax, that's all right. That's acceptable, isn't it? Or maybe a little fraud here and a little fraud there. Maybe as a businessman, lying to your customer and defrauding him. Maybe as an insurance agent, telling people that you're selling hurricane insurance to, that yes, it does cover the floodwaters, when in fact you know that it doesn't. Deceiving people into buying things that they don't need, can't use, shouldn't have, and probably is bad for them, is good for business. And so we lie to people all the time and we steal in other ways. And we seem to think that that's pretty good. You know, what it really boils down to is that I want to steal and I don't want to get punished for it, but I don't want you to steal from me. I want to commit adultery. I want to go nail your wife, but I don't want you over here nailing mine. So we want to commit crime. Human beings are natural criminals. You ever thought about it a little bit? I mean, have you ever cheated on your income tax? You ever cheat on your old lady a little bit? I mean, just, you know, once in a while. No big deal. But you don't want somebody doing that to you. I mean, you know, you don't mind going over here and banging somebody else's wife, but you don't want somebody over here banging your wife. So we don't exactly want to do unto our neighbors what we want our neighbor to do unto us. We'd kind of like to do unto our neighbors that which is expedient and feels real good, but we want our neighbor to be constrained. And as a result of that, we take a look into the Bible and we find there's a statute over here in Scripture in Romans 8, verse 6 or something like that. And it says, the carnal mind, just normal everyday garden variety guys like you and me, Bob, the carnal mind is enmity against God and isn't subject to the law of God, and neither indeed can be. We just don't like the Ten Commandments. We just don't like them. They're too damn restrictive. Let's just be honest about it. But we'd like the Ten Commandments to be enforced and applied to everybody else. I think that thou shalt not commit adultery applied to you, Bob, is a hell of a good law. Thou shalt not commit adultery applied to George Gordon is a really dumb law, and I don't like it. So, our politicians come to us and they say, well, let's slack off on these laws. Now, When we slack off on the adultery law, the natural consequence of that is more adultery, more sexual permissiveness and promiscuity, which degenerates into more divorce, which divorce creates juvenile delinquency and broken homes, and these juvenile delinquents join gangs and they run around on the streets shooting people off the street corners, for which we want these juvenile delinquents to be locked up and the key thrown away. But you and I, Bob, we don't want to curtail our adultery, which causes this juvenile delinquency problem to start with. Now, do we, Bob? Now, you know, one crime leads to another. And the crime of adultery leads to the crime of juvenile delinquency, which leads to the crime of murder, which leads to prisons and jails, which leads to $56 a day that we all have to pay to lock this juvenile delinquent up because he's out shooting people off the street corners. See where we're going with this, children? Now, in law, we say we are the proximate cause of our own injury. God comes along and says, all right, kids, now here's the way we've got to conduct ourselves out in the real world. And we come along and say, well, let's modify that a little bit because there's more fun and frolic with a little adultery. Not a whole bunch now, just a little adultery. We don't want to get carried away now, do we? But shucks, kids, a little adultery leads to a little more and a little more and a little more. And pretty soon, you know, you got a lawless society. And that's where we are here in the United States. I mean, we're just plain lawless here. And we go along with this. We have this great facade over here that we're law-abiding people. And we're just out here really opposed to crime. Did you see this Elliot Spitzer? You know, the law and order prosecutor in New York. And he's out here, and he just, you know, for about 4 or 5 years, we thought he was the greatest champion of law and order until the other day we found out that he's over here gang-banging the whores. Hey, this guy ain't near as moral as you thought he was. And then by this time, we've elected him governor of New York. Now he resigned the other day, and then they got the lieutenant governor over there, and he's involved in some kind of scandal. Wouldn't it be kind of refreshing if we had a Samuel or a Moses to lead us who was actually practicing the Ten Commandments? Now, we want our president, we want our public officials to practice the Ten Commandments. We just don't want to do it ourselves. And then when our president gets caught, you know, dinking around a little bit with a Tootsie, you know, on the side in the Oval Office, we say, well, you know, what he does in his private life is his business. But boys and girls, when the president's in the Oval Office, isn't he working on public business? I know if I had an employee over here that was banging one of my secretaries and they're on the payroll and on the clock, you know, I'd be a little bummed out. I'm really not too concerned about what they're doing in their own on their own time, but, you know, when they're doing it in the Oval Office, when they're doing it in the back coffee room, you know, that'd be kind of unusual, wouldn't it? So I just thought I'd throw that out there for your consideration. Now, the Justice Policy Institute put out an article over here. I'm going to start on it. They're talking about the punishing decade, prisons and jail estimates at the millennium. As the century draws to a close, we can safely predict that America will end the 1990s by having put more people behind bars than in any other decade in our history. Throughout most of the century prior to 1980, the incarceration rate and the raw number of people behind bars has risen and fallen with wars, depressions, economic booms and busts, as well as with the rise and fall of the crime rate. But as the following charts illustrate, the last 30 years, and particularly the last decade, have witnessed the kind of huge jumps in prison commitments that bear no historical comparison. As the doors to new cell blocks opened, the number of prisoners and jail inmates soared, in good times as well as bad times, independent of whether the crime rate rose or fell. As this new analysis by the Washington, D.C.-based Justice Policy Institute shows, In a few short months, America will begin the new millennium with 2 million of its citizens in prison or in jail. Now, boys and girls, that's more people in jail than you have farmers producing your food. And at the turn of the century, we had about half of our people out producing food. Today, we've got less than 2 million, and we got more than that locked up in our jails. Now, back in 1900, we had one person locked up in jail for every 1,666 people in our society. Today, we have one person locked up in jail for every 210 people that are locked up in society. Or about an eight-fold increase, about 800% more. Now, why is it? Is it because today people are eight times more prone to criminal activity or behavior than they were 100 years ago? Do we have eight times more rapists, robbers, and murderers today than we had 100 years ago? What are most of these people locked up in jail for? Okay, you ready for this? Get your pen and paper out here, let me tell you. More than half of the people that are locked up in jail are locked up for drug offenses. They were smoking marijuana. They were splitting lines of coke. They were shooting up with heroin. And so you and I woke up one day and we said, we can't have that, and we locked them up. And it costs us $56 a day to lock them up for a crime that isn't even a crime in the Bible. Did you know that? Smoking marijuana isn't a crime in Scripture. Let me show you that. God, years and years ago, came to a conclusion. He said, we need marijuana. I don't think he called it marijuana, but he came to the conclusion that we needed some. How do I know that? Because he created it. He created it. The creator of the universe, the guy that created the heavens and the earth, created marijuana. Did you know that? If you didn't know it, now you do. Just told you. Now, he also created cocaine and heroin. Did you know that? This guy created everything. And then he gave us an instruction. It's in Genesis chapter 1, verses 29 and 30. Listen to this. He said, behold, I've given you every herb bearing seed which is upon the face of all the earth, and every tree in the which is the fruit of a tree yielding seed to you, it shall be for meat. And to every beast of the earth, and to every fowl of the air, and to everything that creeps upon the earth wherein there is life, I have given every green herb for meat. And it was so. Okay, meat here refers to food, and it's there for food. Now, I'm not advocating smoking marijuana, I'm advocating eating it. Now, there are natives down in South America, and they run around and they pull leaves off of cocoa plants and they chew them. Yeah, they just stick it in their mouth and chew it. Now, if I was walking across the field with you, and I reached up and I took an ear of corn, or a leaf off of a corn, or I took a handful of grass and I stuck it in my mouth and I ate it, would you get real mad at me if I did that? All right. Now, if you wouldn't get too mad at me because I reached out and I grabbed a handful of grass and stuck it in my mouth, if somebody else reaches out and takes a leaf off of a bush and sticks it in his mouth and eating it, is that going to bother you? Okay. What if he takes a leaf off of a cocoa bush? Is that going to really just bum you out? Just really just make you mad as hell? And if the answer to that's yes, could you tell me why? How does that guy over there pulling a leaf off of a cocoa bush, sticking it in his mouth and chewing on it, how does that damage you in any way? Now, I'll concede that maybe it's not a good idea. Maybe it tastes real bad. It kind of reminds me of these laws that we have here in our country concerning seat belts. I remember years ago, I was a lobbyist in the Idaho legislature, and I was in there lobbying for civil rights. And they had a proposal for a seat belt law. I'll tell you the seat belt law story here. So, I went into the legislature to testify against seat belts. I was opposed to seat belts. I'm opposed to seat belts today. I think the seat belt law is dumb, stupid, and it's obnoxious. And so, to emphasize this, being skilled in the legislative process, there's 44 counties in Idaho, so I went to each and every county, and I found two people in each one of those counties that were also opposed to the seatbelt law. That's 88 people. And then there was a few other people that came from Ada County and Canyon County and so on that were opposed to it, which made up 104 people. So we approached the Transportation Committee in the Idaho House of Representatives, 9 members in all. And we went in there to testify against the seatbelt law. Now, that's 104 registered voters from every county in the state. We were just done opposed to it. All right, now, those that were on the other side of the issue who were in favor of the seatbelt law were two men who came from San Francisco, California, representing the National Association of Insurance Underwriters. Two guys in pinstripe suits, dressed real good, looked real good, real smart people, must have been to college, probably had letters after their names, I'd guess. I didn't interview them, but I'd guess they did. And they came into the hearing, and God, they were good. They were really good. They were both very, very articulate. They had slides, pictures, drawings, statistics, facts, figures, numbers. They had their story together. Made a hell of a presentation. I was really impressed. You know, I'm a public speaker, and when I listen to another public speaker, I say, hey, that guy's pretty good. I used to belong to Toastmasters for years, and I made a lot of evaluations, made a lot of speeches, and so I kind of appreciate, you know, a guy that gets up and talks. So they've done a hell of a good job. Now, there's two of these guys that are promoting the seatbelt law, and they're promoting it for the insurance industry, which makes all the sense in the world. I don't deny it. I mean, you know, if you're an insurance company and you're insuring somebody driving a car and they have an accident and go through the windshield, costs you a lot of money. If you could keep them in the car without going through the windshield, you could save a lot of blood, a lot of cuts and bruises. You could save a lot of money. Cut this guy's time in the hospital in half and you save a lot of money at the claims window. So I don't deny it. I think seatbelts are the greatest thing since sliced white bread. And furthermore, anybody that doesn't wear a seatbelt is stupid. So for all of you stupids out there that don't wear your seat belts, just let me know you're dumb. All right. Now that we're all agreed that people that don't wear seat belts are really dummies, do we really want to pay $56 a day, though, to store this dummy in jail because he didn't buckle his seat belt? Or do we want to fine this guy? Well, the answer is this is a deal made in heaven. Because if we can pass a seatbelt law, we can fine these people that aren't buckling their seatbelts and generate revenue for the government and government bureaucracy. So that we can spend it on all those things that government agents and government elected people and government bureaucrats spend money on. And the people will love us because we're out here helping to save the health, safety, and welfare of the general public. And the insurance industry will love us, and they will give us more campaign contributions because we passed the law that they wanted. Now, I want you to know that the people of Idaho, the registered voters of Idaho, we didn't want it. But the insurance industry wanted it. The politicians wanted it because it makes them money. Makes all the sense in the world. So after we had all testified, the committee, now there's 104 people, said, no, we don't want it, and they're all voters in Idaho, and two hooligans from San Francisco who don't even vote in Idaho, for crying out loud, wanted it. So it was reported out of committee 7-2 in favor of the seatbelt law, which was duly enacted into law and signed by Governor John Evans. One day I'm really grousing about this. Rusty Barlow, who was a rep at that time, and I said, and I was using expletives deleted. And he looked at me like I was stupid. And he said, George, you don't understand the legislative process. I'm a lobbyist and I don't understand the legislative process. And I said, okay, Rusty, explain it to me. After all, you've been elected by the people. You're real smart. And he said, you see, George, the Republicans don't have a veto-proof legislature. John Evans is a Democrat. I'm a Republican. The Republicans control both the House and the Senate. And philosophically, we agree with you. We're opposed to government regulation. But we have an education bill. Our education bill is worth $76 million this year, and we want Governor Evans to sign that education bill. So we have a trade-off. Governor Evans wants the seatbelt law, and we want the education bill. You see, George, it's politics. Oh, yeah, Rusty. Oh, I see. It doesn't have anything to do with democracy. It doesn't have anything to do with the will of the people. It doesn't even have anything to do with reason, logic, and common sense. It has to do with the expedience of politics and profits. The insurance company profits by having the seatbelt law. That's a given. And the politicians, they profit from the seatbelt law because they get the legislation that they bargained for. And the bureaucrats love it because they get the fines that come from the violations. And the policemen love it because it gives them something to do. It keeps the cops off the streets and out of the pool halls, for crying out loud. It gives them something to occupy their time. Giving people tickets. Fighting crime. Fighting crime? Excuse me. We didn't have a crime until we passed the seatbelt law. We turned something that's as normal and natural as going to the bathroom, for crying out loud, into a crime. What did we criminalize? Getting in the car and driving down the street. That wasn't a crime until somebody came up with the idea that, well, we need a seatbelt. And now we need a seatbelt law. And so I got to ask you, did you really want to impair your liberty and promote a hassle? You know, before we had seatbelts and seatbelt laws, we had people going through the windshields, but we didn't have any hassle, and we didn't have a crime, because it wasn't a crime. So we created a crime so that we could create a hassle, so that we could enrich the insurance companies and give the cops something to do to fight crime. Would it be out of order if I suggested that we fight crime by locking up adulterers? Maybe we could fight crime by locking up witches and warlocks. Just a wild off-the-wall thought that maybe we could find more crime with violations of the Ten Commandments than we could chewing cocoa leaves. Or driving down the street without your seatbelt buckled. Just a thought. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about The Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. Now, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We got to leave it right there. So we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.